I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe featuring an eclectic menu, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really pleased that today's morning show can be devoted to the concern that predominates all of our headlines right now, the concern that is paramount pretty much in all of our hearts and minds right now, the coronavirus crisis. And we're going to be hearing about this today from somebody who, in a sense, experienced it in a way very different from the rest of us. It's a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage, Dr. Temple Burling, Associate Professor of Biology and Physics, who also teaches courses related to museum studies and the history of science at Carthage. Professor Burling is on sabbatical right now from Carthage, and as a matter of fact, found himself in both the UK and Belgium recently on a research trip as part of his sabbatical project. And as you might guess, his time in Europe was cut short because of the coronavirus, and his trip back into the United States was a bit more complicated than it would otherwise have been. And it's very intriguing to hear from Professor Burling about what he experienced, what he saw, and it tells us something about what our country has managed to do and all that our country has perhaps failed to do in terms of trying to be fully equipped for this crisis. And so I think it's going to be an important story that we're going to be hearing today from Professor Burling. Professor Temple Burling, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's nice to talk with you.
I'm glad we can have this conversation, and thank you for making time for it. Although, as is the case with a lot of us in higher education and in other fields of endeavor, we have a little more free time on our hands than we otherwise would, and I know you find yourself to be in that strange position right now.
Exactly.
Tell us, first of all, the kind of work, just in brief, the kind of work that took you to the UK and to Belgium earlier in March.
Well, this was part of a longer-term bit of work that I've been doing in the history of science and in museum studies with collaborators I have in Milwaukee at the Chipstone Foundation, who also curate exhibits at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And the research trip that I was on was to look at history of production and the science and the manufacture and also artistic aspects of ceramics production in the UK, specifically in the Staffordshire region, in a region of the UK called the the Potteries region, and then going on from there to Belgium and the Netherlands to look at some of the history and manufacturing traditions of so-called Delft pottery, and then finally on to Germany, to what's called the Westerwald region, to look at pottery traditions there. And in all of these cases, I was meeting with curators and experts in the field of ceramics history and collections.
So you were in the United States until the 7th of March, is that right?
Yes, I was and headed over to the UK on the 7th of March, keeping an eye on the COVID-19 situation, looking at the travel announcements from the CDC and from the WHO, and every day we were checking these, and all the information was we should travel, that we shouldn't change our travel plans, and so I took the word of the experts and headed over and made it over without a hitch.
Right. So at that point in time, the coronavirus situation was still serious in China and still serious in South Korea. Remind us, at that point in time, was it still making its presence known, for instance, in Italy, which of course has been a very serious hotspot, and other places in Europe, or not really yet? Or was the seriousness of the situation not yet apparent in Europe?
Yeah, so by the week before I was going, the reports in Italy were starting to get more serious. I actually had cousins who were in Italy at the time, and they were having to change plans. They were in the north of Italy and were having to change plans to head down to Rome, which was not affected at that point. And then ultimately, they also had their plans in Italy totally cut short and had to leave early as well.
Hmm. So tell us where you were and what you were doing when it first became apparent to you that the situation was serious. Actually, ahead of that, when you first got to Europe on the 7th of March, how predominant a concern was this in the people with whom you were interacting? I mean, was this a very common topic of conversation with people on the street and in normal interactions, or not so much?
I would say that everybody was aware of the situation. There were posters in airports and in train stations about reminding people to wash their hands and to cover their mouths and noses if they were sneezing, to take heightened precautions and to avoid contact with people if they were showing symptoms. The people I was meeting, we were sort of jokingly fist bumping or you know, knocking our elbows together, not shaking hands. But you know, I think that by and large, people were very much going about their day. Museums had people in them. I had no cancellations of my early appointments during the trip.
So tell us about when that began to change. What was the first signal that the seriousness of the situation was escalating and was going to directly impact you one way or another?
Well, so I was in the UK for the early part of last week, Monday and Tuesday, and the news reports were getting more, I would say, dire, but I wouldn't say that there was panic in anything that I saw. But the number of cases in the UK were mounting, and also cases in continental Europe were on the rise as well. And the discussion was on the BBC, you would have had to work hard to escape hearing about it, I think. But in my travels from the Staffordshire region through London, and then ultimately taking the Channel train over to Belgium, it seemed as though people were mindful but largely going about their business, and there was no sense of panic that I could see.
So when did that start to change, or at what point did you start to realize that the situation was changing and not for the better?
Yeah, so I went to bed in Antwerp on Wednesday night. That would have been the 11th, and in a lovely part of town in Antwerp, and woke up in the morning to emails saying that I should think about getting back. And
these are emails from who, may I ask?
From my cousins who were in Italy at the point, and also my my wife Leslie Cameron also texted me and said we should start thinking about a change of plans. And I got online and saw Trump's announcement that was later corrected by people in the White House. At first, his announcement was that everybody in Europe would be quarantined and not be allowed back in. Luckily, by the time I woke up, I had found out that as an American citizen, I would be allowed back in. And so I spent the morning online scrambling to try to get a flight back home, and was able to get a seat on a plane out of Brussels on Saturday morning.
And I'm just curious, how difficult was that in and of itself? I mean, were most of the planes pretty much full at that point in time? Were there a lot of people trying to do the same thing you were trying to do?
Well, I tried calling my airline that got me over, Aer Lingus, and I had I couldn't get through by phone. I couldn't make any changes on my reservation on the internet on their website. They were just completely swamped and couldn't handle that. So I was able to get. I tried several things, and my immediate idea was that since they weren't limiting people from the UK, I thought, well, maybe I should try to get a flight back out of London. I was able to get a reservation on a flight out of London, but it would have been it would have been more complicated to get back to London from Brussels. So I was able actually to get a very convenient flight back from Brussels, and I just burned some frequent flyer miles to get a seat.
How far is Antwerp from Brussels?
It's only about an hour train ride. So I got a plane, a reservation, and then quickly made a hotel reservation for Brussels the night before. And really, it was quite smooth sailing for me. So I didn't suffer any of the problems that I've read about with people having to spend $10,000 on a flight home and camp out in the airport. So all of the public transportation was still working like clockwork, as it tends to do in Europe, and you know, people were very gracious at hotels. As I left Antwerp, things were starting to shut down. Some museums I had planned to visit had posted paper notices on the door, shut today. So I just decided at that point to get down to Brussels and just be ready to go.
So is it safe to say then that in Brussels they were already making this move towards what I guess we're calling social distancing?
They were. They had made an announcement that the museums would all be closing on the 14th, on the Saturday, but that they would remain open until through Friday. And since I'm a museum studies person, I decided I had better get over to the main art museum in Brussels to see some paintings that that I was interested in having a look at. I've not been to Brussels before, and my view is that being in a museum is a perfectly acceptable way to maintain social distance if you're visiting alone. So I felt like I was making use of the time, what little time I was going to have left for this research trip.
Right. So explain what the scene was like at the airport in Brussels and the process of boarding and so on. Did it feel any different from business as usual?
It felt different in that everybody was aware that these flights were that many of us were on these flights and hadn't planned to be. I will say that the airport itself was not chaotic. I arrived 4 hours before my flight in anticipation of having to wait for a very long time, and I had no wait at all. I just went very quickly through check-in and through security and was able to wait for about 2.5 hours at the gate. But the flight was relatively full. Of course, by this point, nobody without an American passport or without permanent residency was allowed on the plane. So I assume that most of these people had rebooked onto the flight, many of them maybe into seats that had been would have been occupied by Europeans coming over. Interestingly, on my flight, there was a group of university students coming back from a medical mission tour to Rwanda. The woman sitting next to me was a student from Youngstown State University, and there were about 20 in their group, and they had received word in Rwanda that it might be difficult to get home, so somehow their professors heroically managed to find seats on this plane for about 20 university students and three professors, and they were all headed back. Their work cut short by this outbreak.
And again, that change in their plans was in anticipation of travel back to the United States, perhaps growing even more difficult.
Exactly, and I think that their university made the call, get these young people back as soon as we can, and we'll work things out once they're back stateside.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking on today's morning show with Professor Temple Burling, who is Associate Professor of Biology and Physics at Carthage. And he is telling us today on the morning show about his experience of traveling back from Europe. He was in the UK and Belgium in early March, between March 7th and March 14th, as part of his sabbatical work. His trip to Europe was cut short, his research cut short by the coronavirus outbreak and the concerns about it perhaps becoming impossible at some point for him to be able to return here to the United States. So where we left off, he was safely on a plane in Brussels and on his way back to the United States. The story, of course, is dramatically different in terms of what greets you when you get to O'Hare. First of all, during that flight, and even as you were boarding or as you were disembarking, were you and the other passengers told anything about what you were going to, what you should expect once landing in Chicago?
There was no word from the plane crew, although I think most of us were aware in reading the reports online that we would be subject to some sort of screening when we got off the plane in O'Hare. And I would say that many of us were taking precautions on the plane. We were wiping our surfaces down with antiseptic wipes and covering our noses, although I wasn't hearing sneezing or coughing to any degree on the flight. But I think people were very aware that this was unusual.
So when your plane lands at O'Hare,
yep.
What is the first thing you do? I don't remember the order of events. I don't think you get to go for your baggage until you do something else first. Is that right?
Right. So typically one just goes through immigration, gives your passport. They ask what you are bringing back, and then you go pick up your bag, and then go through customs. I have an app that allows me to get through a little bit faster if everything is working smoothly. But I was told as soon as I got off the plane, no, you're in with everybody else, and you'll just have to wait your turn in line to see an immigration official.
So the app was not applicable in this case, then?
At this point, no. So then I waited, about 10 minutes, 15 minutes to see an immigration official, and then I was immediately put into another line that everybody else on the plane who got off before me was put into as well. And then we were in line standing to then go through some other form of check, talking with immigration officials, and we were told that after that there would be another process, and that we should just remain patient, that this was a process.
So
that was about what we heard.
So not too much. So according to the email that you sent me, you were ultimately standing in line for 3 hours.
It's about 3 hours for me. Now, I was one of the last people off the plane, so there may have been people who were getting through sooner. And they did, during that time, start to open up lines for people who had a sort of certification that's called global entry, that one pays an additional fee for frequent travelers to Europe if you want to avoid lines at immigration. So they were peeling some of those people off, but I would say that was, you know, maybe about 20 people out of a line of people on the plane that was probably in excess of 200 or so folks.
Right. We should also say that you believe that you were on one of the first flights to land at O'Hare after President Trump's travel restrictions had gone into effect.
Right, because they went into effect Friday the 13th at midnight, and I flew out from Brussels on the morning of the 14th of March. I've looked at the schedule going into O'Hare, and there's a flight from Frankfurt that gets in slightly earlier than this Brussels flight, but I think that we were the second flight in.
Right. So that means that in terms of the wait that you experienced at O'Hare was probably shorter than those who landed later.
As we were in line, flights from Paris, from Frankfurt, from Amsterdam came in, and they were backing up the space behind us.
So once you got to somebody who was actually doing something with you, how was that process different from what it would otherwise have been?
Well, this second immigration person asked questions about whether I had been to China. No. Had I been to the EU? Yes, I just got off a flight from Brussels, as has everybody in the line. Did I have any symptoms? No. And that was about it. And then we were sent off after that to a set of health screeners from whom I believe they were from the health department in the city of Chicago.
I'm just curious, do you have any idea what would have happened to you at that point if the answer to any of those questions had been different? I mean, if you had been from China.
No idea.
Okay.
No idea.
Right. So, I mean, fortunately for you, the answers were the most benign answers possible, I guess, except they did ask if you had been to the EU, and that was
right.
A red flag.
Right, and I feel like $1 million, and other than, you know, that I'm not in Europe right now, and so I was able to answer in the negative to all of those.
So,
except for that I had been in Brussels,
right,
and in Belgium.
So tell us what this health screening, what that involved.
Yeah, so there was a set of tables, temporary tables set up with, I would say, somewhere around 20 workers with face masks and plastic face shields covering those.
Wow.
And
that would be a disconcerting sight in and of itself.
I think it would have been, except that some people were wearing face masks that we'd encountered throughout the trip, and I knew that people who are on the front line of this need to protect themselves against possible exposure.
Of course,
so this seemed quite sensible to me that they were doing this.
Right. I only mean that the sight of something like that, I should think, in a very visceral way, just underscores the potential seriousness of the situation and the kind of threat we're talking about.
There was no joking around at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
So what else was involved then in this health screening?
So they pointed an electronic thermometer at my forehead. I suspect it was an infrared thermometer. It read 97 degrees. They again asked me if I had any symptoms. I said no. And then they handed me a photocopied set of instructions saying what I should do if I had recently visited China. So they haven't had time, apparently, to update their recommendations if you've been in the EU, although certainly the recommendations are going to be the same whether one has been in China or the EU at this point. And they really were not able to answer sort of more detailed questions about what my best set of next actions should be. Should I, for example, rent a car on my own and go home, or would it be okay for my wife to pick me up? And they could offer me no good advice on that.
Hmm. What was the set of instructions that you were given that were really crafted for somebody who had flown from China or who had been in China? I'm just curious to know, at least in general, what those instructions amounted to. Are they the kind of things we've already heard about? Were there any surprises in those instructions?
Well, I'm not surprised by any of them. They're telling me to take my temperature every day, twice a day, to call the Wisconsin Health Department if I have any symptoms, to alert them. They have my phone number and email. Presumably, that information will make its way to some health reporting authority at some point. And they just list the symptoms that I should be looking for and to avoid contact with other people for 14 days.
Right. So those kind of measures, I assume you've been trying to follow to whatever extent is possible. Give us some sense of what your daily life has been like. Oh, and by the way, how did you get back home? What was the choice you finally made?
Well, ultimately, we just decided that my wife Leslie was there at the airport. That it seemed as likely that I would, if I were exposed, that I would expose more people by trying to rent a car than by getting a ride home with her. So I sat in the back seat, tried to look the other way and not breathe on her on the drive home. And then I immediately got home and am now camping out in the living room on the couch in front of the fire. We have two doors into the house, and so my wife and my daughter can be in one part of the house and I can be in the other part of the house. And we're sort of figuring this out day to day, how we're going to manage it. But I'm actually quite comfortable sitting by the fire and looking out at a beautiful day.
Hmm. So as you look back at your experience in the airport at O'Hare, what leaves you, in a sense, the most sort of troubled or disconcerted about what you experienced, not so much in terms of the ways in which you and other passengers were inconvenienced, but the ways in which this was carried out that give you cause for concern about the well-being of all of us in this moment of crisis?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, as I think about how this procedure worked, I have no confidence that the U.S. is any safer from exposure to COVID-19 because of this this process than it would have been if we had simply gone through customs and were given a sheet of paper and had our temperatures taken, say, while we were standing in line. This was, it's easy for me to come up with alternate processes, but this looked like it really caught people in Chicago completely off guard and not being able to manage the situation as effectively as I know these people would want to be able to. I'm concerned for people being kept in a confined space for large amounts of time with people who could potentially be carrying the virus, and then increasing the number of people who would have been exposed who otherwise would not have been. I think another thing that I find concerning is there were a number of elderly people, some people with movement issues, and parents with young children, and this was just, it must have been an agonizing experience for these people. I just saw no ability at the point that we were getting into Chicago to accommodate these people who would have had extra requirements for their comfort and for their sense of security. And I guess finally I would say that I felt quite bad for the officials who were there, the uniformed officials who were on the front lines of this, having to be the face of the government's response, and so clearly not being able to project a sense of competence and really being able to be in charge. And I think that they were just very fortunate. We were all very fortunate that there was so much human goodwill and patience and just ability to just make it through a challenging situation and face it with a good deal I think goodwill on the part of the people, and that goodwill was shared really among the crowd. I really didn't hear any sniping or griping or complaining. It was quite different from what you might see in a weather related delay.
It reminds me a bit of what it was like, particularly in the weeks and months right after 9/11.
Oh, absolutely.
One flew, and there were these very stringent security procedures in place, and I don't remember ever hearing the slightest word of complaint. One was grateful, in fact, and in a sense, grateful to be inconvenienced. It sounds like in this case, maybe in the moment, people were gracious, but now you, as you look back, wish that this had been handled very, very differently. I mean, you and your fellow passengers were inconvenienced, but in a way that was not necessarily serving the public good as effectively as we might wish. Is that fair?
This is my concern. Yeah. That in fact, conveniences are fine if this is actually doing something that's positive. But if it's not doing something positive, or if it's potentially aggravating the situation, this is not a situation that we should probably just gloss over.
You mentioned in your email to me something about the timeline, and I think it might be important for this to be underscored. And I'm talking about the matter of federal officials having a certain amount of time during which they presumably could have helped places like O'Hare to be better prepared for this situation. Just exactly what is that timeline, and what do you wish would have happened within that span of time, whatever it was?
Well, I recognize that this was very fluid, but there was an announcement, the press conference on, I believe, Wednesday night, announcing the travel ban, and that would have given some number of days, at least 24 hours, maybe 48 hours, in which to get some sort of more coordinated response in airports like O'Hare to the rush of Americans and permanent residents trying to get home.
So what day are we on in terms of your self-quarantine, this period in which you need to be isolating yourself as much as possible from everybody, including your own wife and daughter?
So if I'm reading my packet from the CDC correctly, I'm officially in day one. Yesterday doesn't count.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So.
So you have you have 14 days or 13 days to go.
Well, as I read it, that's what, and I don't know, I don't have any sense of what kind of you know, I'm very confused as to what is actually required of me. You know, am I allowed to be driving a car? Am I allowed to be? I mean, I'm assuming I can go for a bike ride if the weather is nice. That it's fine for me to go for a walk, but it's not clear to me fully whether I can go to the grocery store or when and if I can start helping with the cooking and the cleaning around the house, or if I'm just going to have to be sitting in my living room for 2 weeks.
Wow. Are you planning to try to seek out the answers to those legitimate questions?
Yeah. So, you know, both my wife and I are on online and trying to get some sort of definitive answer, and it's very hard to get a clear recommendation at this point. But I have a suspicion that in the days and weeks to come, we will get the public health people will coordinate a response, and we'll get more of a sense of what we should be doing to protect the ourselves and the public.
Right. And needless to say, in the meantime, you are, maybe it's the wrong word to say erring, but I'll say you're erring on the side of caution. I mean, choosing to be more cautious rather than less cautious.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when the CDC makes recommendations, you know, I as a scientist am going to take these seriously. And, you know, I think that I and other people just have to take the words of the scientific experts on this. And when there is consensus, we follow these recommendations, because these are the people who know best how to deal with these uncertain events. They know the science, they know the modeling, and when they get a coordinated set of recommendations, I think we as the public would do very well to listen to the experts in this.
I'm speaking with Dr. Temple Burling, who is Associate Professor of Biology and Physics at Carthage College, talking with Professor Burling about his experience of cutting short a research trip to the UK and in order to return home ahead of this travel ban taking effect. So he is now safely sequestered at his home at the outset of what he presumes will be a 14-day period of quarantine. You're feeling fine at this point, I assume.
Yep.
Demonstrating no symptoms whatsoever.
That's right.
Very good.
So I'm planning to go out for a walk this afternoon.
Very good.
But I will stay away from people.
Very good. And I wonder if we could take a moment for you to reflect on what you in general have observed during this experience, which relates to the whole matter of science and the place of science in our lives, and the way in which we listen to science and to scientists. And of course, this has been a topic of considerable discussion and some concern even before this coronavirus crisis began. I'm just curious if you have any sort of new thoughts about that, given what you have experienced and seen thus far?
Well, one thing is that we have, in this country, seen outbreaks in the past of various viruses, various bacterial, maybe not epidemics, but the CDC and other public health organizations are not new to this problem. And, for example, after the after 9/11, I don't know, you may recall there was an anthrax scare, and as a result, the CDC and other agencies put together a very extensive set of guidelines for how to respond in these times of crisis and how to get messages to the public and who should be responsible for the messaging. And one of the things that that is recommended in these guidelines is that the message be coming from a single expert, that this shouldn't be politicized, but that scientists should be doing the messaging, and that scientists should be telling the truth. They should say what we do know, and they should say what we don't know, because the public can deal with the truth. What's problematic for the public is when messages are either rosy for no scientific reason or overly grim for no scientific reason. The public can deal with lack of information. What's very difficult for the public is when there's a great deal of confusion and conflicting information. And I think that one of the things we're seeing in this particular case is an example of what happens when one doesn't follow these very, I think, very quite reasonable recommendations that our scientists have put out there.
It's interesting. I think you're making a valuable observation there that things can tilt in both directions, that it might be politically expedient for a certain person, a certain official, to paint this in rosier terms, if for no other reason than for the sake of keeping the public calm, and or making themselves look like they're not presiding over a worse situation than it is. And on the other hand, such announcements can also tilt in the other direction, in which a situation is painted as actually more serious or more dire than in fact it is. Again, one could imagine a scenario if this has become politicized where that might be to somebody's advantage. And I can see how both of those extremes are a source of tremendous concern at a time like this. We are not well served by that.
Right. And this virus doesn't care about politics at all, right? So, I mean, at this point, what we need are the experts who are the scientists and the health policy experts to be in the driver's seat, making policy and making recommendations. And politicians need, on both sides of the aisle, need to be listening to our experts, because frankly the politicians are not experts in this, and when they presume to be, this puts the public at risk.
Absolutely. I know this is nothing for which you have professional expertise as such, but I would be really curious to know your opinion of what you have seen in terms of the coverage of this, that is, the kind of job that the media is doing in covering this situation.
Well, I should say I'm a bit of a Luddite when it comes to social media. So I don't have Facebook, or I don't do that. So mostly what I'm doing is reading the New York Times and getting information from NPR and that sort of thing. I don't watch the news on television. So my sense is that what I'm hearing is what a lot of WGTD listeners are hearing as well.
Very good. Well, I applaud your taste in sources of information, needless to say. So again, you are at the outset of a self-quarantine period for 14 days, and it's interesting this is occurring during your term of sabbatical, and I don't recall, is this just the semester or all year long?
I'm fortunate to be able to take a year this year, so I'm in the home stretch, though, of this, and very much mourning the loss of the opportunity in the Netherlands and in Germany at this point, because those were rather central to some of the questions that I and my collaborators were hoping that I could do some investigation into. But nonetheless, I was able to have a very fruitful couple of days in the UK, and so all is not lost in terms of that.
Right. And so does this reshape ultimately what your project will be, or do you intend to carry on, albeit with a few missing pieces?
Oh, I'll carry on with a few missing pieces, and as soon as I can get back to the Netherlands and to Germany, I'll be, as my schedule and finances allow, I'll be on the first plane I can to be back there.
Very good. And the ultimate goal with this sabbatical project is what?
Well, in a nutshell, one of the questions that I ask as a scientist who loves museums is, why are there so many pots and articles of pieces of porcelain and pieces of ceramics in museum collections? I can sort of understand why there's so many paintings, right? But why are there so doggone many pieces of ceramics? And in the course of asking that question with my colleagues, who are ceramics curators, it turns out there are probably as many answers to that question as there are pieces of ceramics in museums. So this is all part of expanding sets of inquiry into why human beings have produced and find so compelling these marvelous objects that we make out of pottery, and why we love them, why we keep them in museums, and why we continue to tell stories about them and what they say about us as people, as scientists, as artists, as just people with everyday lives.
Hmm. Sounds fascinating, and we wish you well as you continue this work, and we indeed hope that circumstances sooner rather than later will allow you to safely return to Europe and to resume your research. And in the meantime, we certainly wish you well in this period of quarantine, wish you and your family well, and I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show to talk about your experiences. Dr. Temple Burling, Associate Professor of Biology and Physics at Carthage College, thank you so much for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you, Greg.
On the morning show, an interview which we recorded late last week with three people representing the Racine Unified School District and their important referendum, which is on the ballot for April 7th. Brian O'Connell and Mike Frontier from the school board, and Shannon Gordon, who is the chief of operations for Racine Unified, will be talking about the referendum, how it was crafted, and why they believe it is so necessary. That is tomorrow on the morning show. Wednesday, an interview I recorded with best-selling author Neil Bascom, the author of a marvelous book called Faster, How a Jewish Driver, an American Heiress, and a Legendary Car Beat Hitler's Best. It chronicles the ferocious interest in race car driving in the 1930s, which became very much a nationalist effort, and Adolf Hitler was very, very keen on Germany becoming the predominant power in race car driving. Those wishes were thwarted in 1938 in a very important race that, in some ways, harkened back to the triumph of Jesse Owens at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. But this story is almost not known at all. But thanks to Neil Bascom, now it is shared with the public. That's on Wednesday. On Thursday, I'll be replaying out of the archives my interview with John M. Berry, the author of probably the definitive book about the flu epidemic of 1918, his book, The Great Influenza, the epic story of the deadliest plague in history. I don't think I need to explain why that is a timely rebroadcast. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.